I've participated in the UU 101 class more times than I can probably count, as many as four times a year for 25 years. And one of the activities that we've always had in that class is the opportunity for participants to create a timeline describing their spiritual journey. And every time I did it, I would create a new timeline for my spiritual journey. And, you know, some things would stay the same, some things would change. One of the events that always makes the timeline is the death of my grandfather when I was 10 years old. At the age of 87, Grandpa Barnes, that's my mother's father, was diagnosed with terminal liver cancer. My family was close to Grandpa, except geographically. He lived in South Carolina with a second wife, and we lived in Michigan. We visited him when he had surgery in the summer, and then in the fall, he felt well enough around World Series time to come up to Michigan. But his illness then progressed, and the demands became so much that they were too great for his wife to care for him, and she put him in a nursing home. There, after a while, a wonderful, compassionate nurse contacted my mom and told my mom that my grandfather's wife had stopped visiting, and no one else was visiting either. Essentially, he was abandoned, dying in that nursing home. Seemingly without hesitation, my mom flew down to South Carolina, chartered an air ambulance, got a hospital bed and a commode and a walker, and brought him back to Michigan to live with us for his last days. So she put him in the room next to my parents' bedroom where all of us had been as babies. And my mom cared for her father for these last days of his journey. Mostly she gave him the gift of love. And helpful that she had a nursing background too. Grandpa's family doctor would come every week or two and mostly just talk to him. We had never heard of hospice, but that's what this was, hospice care. My grandfather spent the last 6 weeks of his life with us. And during this time, he never heard from his wife. I wondered what that must have been like for him. Yet he kept his customary good grace, great sense of humor. He threw himself into the life of our family, making sure he'd get in his walker, with his walker, down to every dinner. And with good humor and laser accuracy, he made fun of my family. For example, we're a very talkative bunch, except when we're eating ice cream. My dad and all my siblings were very intent on that and scrape until we get every last bite out of that ice cream. All scraping, and Grandpa thought that was hilarious. He gave us the precious gift of laughing at ourselves. Now, being just 10 years old, I was pretty oblivious to the level of work that it had to take my mom especially, but also my dad, to keep him there. Helping him every time he had a bowel movement, emptying his catheter, giving him medicine, bathing him, doing the laundry, staying near and checking on him during the night. It just had to be an exhausting list. Not to mention the emotional burdens, of course. No doubt, Grandpa was a burden, a tremendous burden, a burden that my mom would not have traded for all the tea in China, as she liked to say. The last few days of his life, Grandpa became disoriented. He would say, "Where's the newspaper?" And we'd bring it in, and he'd look at it, turn to the obituaries, and say, "What? I'm not in here? I worked for this paper for 50 years, and they don't even give me an obituary." "Well, Grandpa, you're not dead yet. I mean, how else do you say that, right?" It was getting to be time. He was ready. And then on a Sunday evening, as my siblings and I were watching 60 Minutes, my dad came in to say, "Grandpa died, and would we like to go see him one last time?" So we quietly filed in that bedroom, and he just had this look of utter peace. And for me, that was a lasting, powerful gift he gave me. Death was not this violent, awful thing that I saw on TV, but could be peaceful, serene. And I realized we had given Grandpa a powerful gift too, being surrounded by family in his last days. Flash forward now to the late 1990s. I received at that time, a gift from my grandmother on my dad's side, whom we called Nani. Surprising this gift was because she had been dead for 15 years. Now, when she died, I got a gift from her. We all 14 grandkids, got to pick one of her possessions, and we took that. I picked her desk, a beautiful wood desk, 100 years old, made in Grand Rapids, fine furniture. And it had these really cool cubby holes that I always liked as a kid, and little sliding doors and little drawers. Now, I hauled that desk around with me in graduate school, up to Wisconsin. And while it was never comfortable to work at the desk, it was a center, it still is, of our family life. It's where, for example, we keep the envelopes and the stamps. Well, one day in the late 1990s, I was going to go get a stamp, and I pulled open the little drawer, and I couldn't find them. And I knew, I just bought stamps. What happened to them? My wife, Amy, said, well, maybe they kind of got to the back of it and fell behind a little bit. So I pulled the drawer out, and sure enough, there it was. And then I realized that this desk had a design flaw. Behind the cubby holes beneath the drawer, there was a little compartment. And I realized that all sorts of stuff, maybe over the years, fell down into that compartment on each side of the desk. Tried to get my hand in and down. Too big. Amy tried. Nope. Then our kids put their hand in. They could do it. And they started pulling out stuff. It was amazing. They pulled out long-lost treasures and just routine stuff like bills, tax records, dry cleaner receipts from the 1940s and 50s, a yellowed newspaper clipping, my grandfather's obituary from 1961. Then we moved to the other side, pulled that drawer out, and they put their hands in and they started pulling out photographs. Probably 50 photographs, ranging from the 1910s to the 1970s. What an incredible treasure! Pictures of aunts and uncles and cousins and siblings and my parents and lots of people my dad could not identify. My kids pulled out picture after picture, each with a story to tell. There was a picture of Nani and Grandpa just dressed beautifully in a bright sunny day, Easter Sunday, 1946, it said on the back. The war is over. My grandmother wrote the scripture reading from the day and then said, glorious Easter Sunday after helpful sermon. I like that. Then there was a picture of them at their 40th wedding anniversary. There was a picture of my grandfather very close to the time he died, looking like FDR did just before his death. You can see it coming. There was a picture of me, 1 year old, looking more like my son Ian than I ever knew I looked. And then most intriguing of all, there was a little tiny picture of a man and a woman arm in arm on a beach, obviously in love, my grandmother, not my grandfather. We could tell this had been removed from a photo album or a scrapbook. What a story that picture has, and I'll never know it. So a bunch of pictures that, like the scraps of paper on the other side of the desk, construct a life, my grandmother's life. Did Nani ever wonder what happened to those financial records? Did she wonder what happened to the photographs, especially the mystery man? What was she thinking when she removed that from the scrapbook? She realized she had lost it? And how amazing that I had unwittingly carried these treasures around with me for 15 years before discovering them. Finding these long-buried treasures reminded me of all the gifts that my grandmother had given me. I was so lucky to grow up a mile away from where she lived, so she was such a part of my life. Every Halloween, we'd get dressed up and go over there first to trick-or-treat at her place. Every Christmas, this was really great, we'd go over to pick her up Christmas morning, and she'd have a huge suitcase of presents. Every pancake supper at her Methodist church, we would go. And she was there for the most important events of my childhood, cheering me on. I always felt her unconditional love and support. 5 years after she died, Amy and I used a gift from her for the down payment on our first house in Appleton. And then there was the time, pretty close to the end of her life, where I was visiting her for one of the last times. Her mind had been lost in a haze of old memories. She would talk in a muddled way about things that happened 70 or 80 years ago. It didn't make any sense. Maybe with that picture of the guy on the beach make a little more sense now. And in her haze, it was hard to know if she even recognized me. Actually, she called me Bruce, which was the name of her kid brother who died around the age of 8 for the last years of her life. But suddenly that visit, she took my hand and she said, "Roger, are you happy?" An amazing moment. The treasures in Nani's desk are a tangible reminder to me of the gifts that she gave me that are still with me. I am who I am today partly because of my grandmother. She's a part of me, a deep and important part. Same with Grandpa Barnes, same with my mom. The fact that Nani and Grandpa Barnes and my mom are dead now doesn't change that one little bit. So the web, the good metaphor for human connectedness. We are all embedded in webs of relationship. And at the heart of relationships, which are good and loving, there is a simple act of caring. Grandpa Barnes caring for my mom for Grandpa. I can picture him giving her a bath when she was a baby and her bathing him in his dying days. Simple acts of caring. Nani for my dad for her as she got old and ill. My parents for me for my mom when she was dying. Talk about interdependence. In relationships of love and family, there is a wonderful, sometimes dizzying dance as we go in and out of the role of caregiver and care receiver. And I don't want to romanticize this. Most of this is mundane, common as mud, as the poet would say. Changing a baby's diaper, emptying your father's commode. There is nothing romantic or glamorous about this work, but these are the acts that make human relationships real and meaningful. These are the acts that sustain our lives. And as my mother discovered when Grandpa Barnes was dying, in each of these caring gifts, we do receive even more than we give. Helping another family member through a challenging time is part of what it means to be in family. The ethicist Gilbert Meinlander writes, "Is this not in large measure what it means to belong to a family, to burden each other, and to find almost miraculously that others are willing, even happy, to carry such burdens?" And so in families, we are burdens to each other. I know when I had babies, wow, talk about burden. With my mom, when she was dying, it's a burden. Sometimes we get burdened from both ends at the same time. I want to make some important qualifications here. The first is that true and deep caring is not present in all families, and that is a great tragedy. Some of you may be from families where love and caring really wasn't there, and that to me is as tragic as the absence of food or shelter. Second thing is there are times when the best thing we can do for a family member is nothing. Tough love. When the best thing we can do is not rescuing them from problems they're creating. And finally, there are times when we can't take on all the burdens ourselves, when in order for us to survive and to be able there for the long haul, we have to say no to something. But these exceptions aside, at the heart of the web of family relationships is this simple act of caring. And too often today, that opportunity is cut off. We cut it off. There's the American idol of self-reliance, which is a piece of this. Self-reliance becomes an idol when we would rather suffer than admit we need someone else's help. Or when we say to someone, just lift yourself up by your bootstraps. Self-reliance taken to extreme denies the reality of interdependence. It destroys the acts of caring. It makes them impossible to happen that are at the heart of our relationships. And so instead of worshiping the idol of self-reliance, I want to burden my loved ones. Not all the time, but when I need help, when I am sick, when I am struggling, when my time comes to die. And I want them to burden me. This is what it means to be a family. And then there's another reality in American life, and that is the reality of mobility. When a generation or two ago, children and parents and grandchildren and even extended family lived near each other, now we're far flung in so many cases. My own family stretches from coast to coast. So there's a lot of us in that boat. There's some of us in the boat of being from families where there really wasn't love and caring present. And this is when we really need religious community. In a religious community like this one, we have the opportunity to care for one another as if we're in an extended family. And like an extended family of yesteryear, this is an intergenerational place. When we start together every service, we are in this room babies to 80 or 90 years old. And where else does that happen in our society on a regular basis? And I've seen so many acts of caring in this congregation over the years. Surrogate grandparents, showing up to shovel, tending the garden for someone who's dying. The list goes on. Beautiful, mundane acts. And in congregations like this, we have the opportunity to dance between this role of caregiver and care receiver, helping one another through the sorrows and the challenges that inevitably and periodically visit our lives. I've been helped by you just in the last week in the aftermath of my father-in-law's death. Grandparents and parents, couples without children and single adults and empty nesters and youth and children, we help one another. And we are helped by one another. This is the ministry that each one of us shares in. Caring. It's what we promise when we dedicate a baby. It's what we say to new members who join. We promise to the baby, to the parents, to the new members that we will be there with you and for you. And it is this promise that lies at the heart of this religious community.